is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5. Many areas remain at risk of flooding tonight as strong winds and rain combine with high tides and swollen rivers. The worst hit areas are southwestern England and Wales, where 9 severe flood warnings are in place. Mandy Purchase has been flooded in the village of Minsterworth.
Just disinfecting and getting as much water out as we can, and then, well, our sitting room is the biggest damage with all the furniture and the carpet, yeah, which we've had to pull out.
Meanwhile, the government's denying job cuts at the Environment Agency will affect flood defences. The Environment Secretary's insisting the organisation will continue to protect frontline services despite budget cuts. The son of Valerie Graves, who was found murdered in West Sussex, says her family were lucky they got to spend one final Christmas with her. The 55-year-old was house-sitting in the village of Bosham near Chichester when her body was found on Monday. During a news conference, the artist's son, Tim Wood, struggled with an appeal for help.
This has been a devastating... It is devastating for the family and has come as a complete shock. We would appeal to anyone who has any information about this, no matter how trivial it is, to contact the police to help us catch whoever has done this horrible act.
Scottish and Southern Energy will pay compensation to those affected by Christmas power cuts. £54,000 will be paid to all domestic and business customers who are without electricity for 48 hours. The leader of the British National Party, Nick Griffin, has been declared bankrupt. He says he'll remain a member of the European Parliament and use the experience to produce a booklet on dealing with debt. Next says its shareholders will receive a dividend worth hundreds of millions of pounds. The retailer's had a strong Christmas and now expects its annual profits to be up by £700 million. And stand-up comic Sarah Millican has married fellow comedian Gary Delaney. The 38-year-old announced her surprise wedding news on Twitter, telling fans, "We are loved up and beaming." That's the latest. I'm Anna Collinson.
BCFM.
Yes, sorry to interrupt UB40 there, but it's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Welcome to 2014. Whilst our politicians are off on their holidays, helping me look forward to the year is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. I'm Tony Gosling, and after the 6 o'clock news, Monday sees the first barrister's strike in Britain for 700 years. It's all over cuts to legal aid. Lawyers are saying these changes, started by UK Bilderberg Supremo, now being carried on by Justice Secretary Chris Grayling, will mean the end to justice in Britain, as only the rich will be able to afford to pay for it. There's also the local and the European elections. Is there any point in voting? And totalitarian China's to build a one-party nuclear power station at Hinkley, operated by one of the most corrupt energy companies, EDF. Will it ever really happen? Plus, February's Sochi Olympics. How real are these terrorist threats after we've seen over 30 dead this week in nearby Volgograd? All in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius, some light rain and strong winds. This weekend, highs of 5 Celsius, some heavy showers and again strong winds. Next week, highs of 9 Celsius, fairly dry week with plenty of sunshine. Still some strong winds lessening as the week progresses and that storm disappears. Next weekend, 11th and 12th of January, highs of 7 Celsius, sunshine and showers and also gusty winds. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, helping us have a look at this week's news, because we don't let the news hounds get away with it, as many current affairs programmes disappear off over Christmas break, we definitely will be looking at some of the news stories that have taken place over the last few weeks. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, probably the big story of the last week or so, is these two bombs in Volgograd. It used to be called Stalingrad back in the old days. Now it's Volgograd. It's about 400 miles north-north. East of Sochi with the Olympics, and we've got 34 people dead, something like 60 still in hospital.
Yeah, very depressing. Of course, these kind of events are all too familiar from places like Iraq and Syria. The real issue, of course, behind all of this is that when Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia visited President Putin some months ago,
that was in August, wasn't it? Last year, yeah.
He said that he asked Putin to back off. This is all from the Daily Telegraph. He asked Putin to back off from supporting Assad in Syria, and if he did, he was prepared to buy up to $30 billion worth of Russian weapons. And then he said that if you don't back off on backing Assad, the Chechen separatist terrorists in the south of Russia will be attacking the Sochi Olympics. Now, to be honest with you, Tony, the Russian state does not have a good record on human rights in the Caucasus region. And Litvinenko's book, Blowing Up Russia, explicitly accused the FSB, the Russian Secret Service, as being behind those attacks. But on the other hand, there is forces in the world who want to destabilise the Russian Federation.
To be clear here, Litvinenko is the guy who died of polonium poisoning in London,
correct,
isn't he? I mean, there's a whole, almost two ends to that story. The one end over in Russia with his book, Blowing Up Russia,
yeah.
And then another end here in London.
Yes, and in fact, in the Daily Mail, can you believe, there was quite an interesting article where they suggested that it probably wasn't the Russians or the Russian state that had murdered Litvinenko, not least because the polonium trail led back to the offices of Boris Berezovsky, who supposedly committed suicide, if you remember.
Now, you say a trail led back to his office. Do you mean actually literally radioactive trail?
Yeah. Now, the point is that we're never going to know the detail of who's behind all of these atrocities. The fact is that the intelligence services of the world, the FSB, the NATO intelligence services, Mossad and other groups like this engage in the provocations and terrorism all the time. So when a bomb like this goes off, it could be genuinely disgruntled people who are genuinely taking out their ill will on random people, or it could be part of some political game. And I think it's important that we shouldn't jump to conclusions. I mean, obviously, an attack upon civilians like this is indefensible, from any point of view, but don't presume we know what's going on here, because we probably don't.
Now, there's a bit of deja vu here, because obviously in the run-up to the London Olympics there were all sorts of worries that there was going to be possible terror attacks on the London Olympics in 2012.
Well, yes, and of course it was suggested that the Iranians might be the cause of that. That's what Jonathan Evans, the head of MI5, suggested. I find that extraordinarily. I just don't believe that for a second. What possible motive would the Iranians have for attacking the London Olympics? But of course, the Sochi Olympics in the south of Russia, the Russians have got their enemies, including in the Western intelligence services, for example, the Saudi intelligence services. It looks very much as if Prince Bandar and the Saudi intelligence services, the Mukhabarat, may have been behind the so-called chemical weapons attack in Damascus. The fact is that these horrible things are going on all the time, and if we're aware of it happening now in Russia, but of course, no doubt this very week in Iraq and in Syria, many people have died in similar circumstances.
Yes, Volgograd, very close to Sochi, a big transport hub. We have had apparently three deadly attacks there now, two more recently, and then one a few months ago in October. Ultimately, is there anything that someone like Putin can do? Because the Americans are saying to him, well, we want to know that these Olympics are going to be safe.
Well, I mean, there's been all sorts of talk about people boycotting the Sochi Olympics because of the authoritarianism of Putin and the fact that the parliament there is debating certain anti-gay legislation and so on. I think the reality is that the world we're living in now, terrorism is becoming ubiquitous, but it's becoming ubiquitous not because there's just because of genuine grievances. There's manipulation going on. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, explicitly threatened Putin that if he didn't back down over Syria, there would be consequences for the Olympics. So it may well be, it's possible, that these attacks are being orchestrated from Riyadh in order to put pressure on Putin to back down over Syria. Now, I'm not saying that that is what's happening. I don't know. I don't live in Volgograd, and even if I did, I don't suppose I'd know.
Well,
don't presume that we can assume anything.
The Russian authorities and the Western press are pointing to a certain attacker, possibly as the person behind this. He's called, apparently he's the self-appointed emir of the Caucasus, Doku Umarov. Now, in July, just before Bandar's visit to Moscow, he posted a video on the internet calling the Olympic Games satanic and saying that he would close them down.
Well, yes, but the question is, well, who's pulling his strings? And we know that the Russian state has not behaved very well in Chechnya. They invaded Chechnya in the first place under the Yeltsin regime when they declared independence. They fought a war, they gained independence, and then supposedly, even though they were then independent, they carried out an attack into Dagestan, and then they blew up bombs in Moscow and Ryazan. Now, we know from the book Blowing Up Russia that in actual fact that was all orchestrated by Berezovsky and Putin, because Berezovsky and Putin were on the same page at that stage. The oligarchy knew that in November 1999 there was going to be a presidential election in Russia, and Gennady Zyuganov, the leader of the Communist Party, was well ahead in the opinion polls because people were fed up with the kind of free market free-for-all which Russia had ended up in. But what happened before the elections, all these bombs went off, Putin rides in on a white horse, and suddenly the communists are pushed to one side. Now, that's very similar to the kind of things that were done to keep the Communist Party of Italy out of power in the 70s and the 80s by NATO intelligence services. The point is that terrorism has usually got some political point which isn't obvious. And it may be that there are, you know, that because of Putin's support of Assad in Syria, the Saudis and the Qataris, for example, they have big influence in amongst these jihadi groups in the southern Caucasus because they provide them with weaponry and money. So it's everybody putting pressure on everybody else. But of course, in actual fact, the ordinary people suffer.
Now, this Doku Umarov, as this self-proclaimed emir of the Caucasus, has declared that holding the global sports spectacular in the Black Sea resort amounts to demonic dances on the bones of our ancestors. He said his band of rebels would use all means to derail the event. Now, you know, to what extent can we just take this at face value as these people being genuine freedom fighters from the Caucasus?
Well, I mean, the fact is that it was in the 1870s or 1890s, I think, that the Islamist, or the Muslim population of that area was removed. So there's a long list of grievances going back a long way here. You've got several different groups operating there, some of them looking for an Islamic caliphate, some of them fighting for independence. And I think a lot of this stuff is being manipulated by outside intelligence services, just as the FSB quite possibly bombed Moscow in 1999 in order to achieve their objectives. It's quite possibly the Saudi Mukhabarat who are behind this, because it looks very much like this chemical weapons attack, which everybody's getting so aerated about earlier in the year, was definitely not carried out by the Assad regime, but carried out by the rebels. The same kind of rebels that are now fighting in Fallujah and in Ramadi, and the fighting inside Syria, and of course there's an international network of these people, and they're also fighting in the South Caucasus. Now, this international jihadi network, let's think back to how this was originally set up. It was originally set up in the 1980s under Operation Cyclone to drive the Russian army, the Red Army, out of Afghanistan. And MI6 were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone, and London was the headquarters of the International Islamic Brigades. And that is why we still have an Islamic presence in this country, because MI6, our own intelligence services, encouraged such people to come here and use them for their own purposes. And I'm afraid that is still going on. And everybody is using terrorist groups in order to get leverage, political leverage, over their opponents.
Also, this week, New Year's Honours list. The Daily Mirror reports fury at New Year's Honours for David Cameron's Tory cronies and credit crunch banker. Now, isn't this normal, though, that the Prime Minister has a big say in who gets these New Year's Honours, and everyone is going to be criticising them because it's his mates and a lot of the people who are getting these honours?
Well, basically, it's just normal corruption, isn't it? People give money to the Conservative Party, and then they get New Year honours.
Well,
simple as that, really.
A knighthood for Paul Tucker. He's the former Bank of England deputy governor who faced questions over the LIBOR scandal. Well, he faced questions, but he was also passed over, wasn't he? Because he was the favourite to be governor when they brought in Mark Carney at the last minute, at the beginning of last year, to take over. Mark Carney, of course, being much trumpeted as the guy who's from the Bank of Canada. Only the fact that everyone brushes over the fact he's actually one of the major figures at a much more important bank, which is the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. So this is a sort of sop to Paul Tucker to say, well, we're sorry, we sort of sidelined you in the big job at the Bank of England. Am I right in thinking that the Prime Minister appoints the Bank of England governor for 5 years and then there's very little they can do during that time?
That's true, because the Bank of England was made independent by Gordon Brown. This is really silly in a way if you think about it, because you've actually created an institution which you've got no direct control over. In the past, of course, the Bank of England was nationalised by the Labour government in 1946, and it was, you know, made to be a team player in the formation of policy. Making them independent is what's been pushed for many years by the financial services sector, because they then say, well, we don't have to deal with these democratic politicians who are going to change their minds all the time.
Independent isn't necessarily the right word, though, is it? Because there's
independence of democracy, but it's not independence of power. In other words, they become essentially a creature of the financial markets. Now, it's even clearer with the Federal Reserve in the United States of America, which is printing money hands over fist, as is the Bank of England, that these institutions have been captured by those they are supposedly regulating.
So how does it work? So the Prime Minister appoints the governor. He's then given a free hand to do pretty much what he wants.
Yeah, within the terms of reference of which he's been given. I mean, the Federal Reserve, for example, in the US, does have terms of reference which allow it to deal with both inflation and unemployment, whereas traditionally the Bank of England has only been interested in inflation and not in unemployment. So Mark Carney is trying to push them more in the direction of being more interested in unemployment, which is actually code for we should be allowed to print money. So the Bank of England prints money.
But why is it code for that?
And so does the Federal Reserve. But the European Central Bank has not, in fact, printed much money, because the Germans are not really keen on that sort of thing. So there's actually, you know, there's differences in policies being pursued inside the Eurozone and outside the Eurozone.
Yeah, but Mark Carney said very, very clearly, once employment comes down a bit, inflation can go up, interest rates can go up, and we can start going back to more normal interest rates without these.
Yeah, well, that's
and
just
that may possibly happen much sooner than we think, because unemployment is now going down. I mean, for a lot of people, myself included, would be rather sceptical about these figures, because a lot of these jobs are part-time jobs that are coming, the new jobs, but at the end of the day, it looks like we may be seeing the interest rates creeping up fairly soon. I mean, maybe not this year, maybe next year. What's your thoughts about when
that's
going to happen?
The fact is, we've now got negative interest rates given the rate of inflation, and that's the only thing that keeps the economy from collapsing. And that is not a good situation. Any interest rates, they're saying we will raise interest rates eventually, but we can't do it yet because it'll cause a crash.
So you're saying inflation is higher than interest rates are. Why is that not good?
Well, because it means that in actual fact you're printing money in order to try and get the economy off the bottom. So any growth you're seeing, don't forget we've had 5 years of money printing and zero inflation rate, zero interest rates. Now, if you run an economy for 5 years printing money like it's going out of fashion and with zero interest rates, you might expect some kind of growth to happen in the end, and so it has transpired. But that is not sustainable. Normally, under a normal setup in the capitalist system before the 2008 crash, you'd expect interest rates to be, to be positive, 2, 3, 4, 5% after inflation at minimum, and the money printing would not be going on, because of course that's ultimately basically undermining the currency. But in actual fact, this recovery that we are seeing, if it is one, is basically in the property market in Britain. It's in the stock market in the US, which is reaching new highs all the time, and the real economy, in fact, is still stumbling along the bottom. Now, ultimately, that is actually classic conditions for a mega crash, which is what Gordon Brown pointed out in an article he wrote for the New York Times
before
Christmas.
We haven't heard from the former Prime Minister for a long time. It's the first thing we've heard of him. He's saying, watch out, there may be another crash coming.
Exactly, and he wasn't just talking about British politics and British policy, he was talking about the whole setup. People still living in the past, where they think that we're discussing what British policy should be within a context where we can't determine international policies, and therefore, you know, we've just got to make do, you know, fight our own corner in our own way. But the reality is that we're in an international, globalised financial system in which London is one of the key hubs, and it's not just about Britain. The potential here is for a crash which is going to reverberate around the world and drag everybody down.
Now, Gordon Brown's article was published on the 18th of December called Stumbling Towards the Next Crash. In early October 2008, he says, 3 weeks after the Lehman Brothers collapse, I met in Paris with leaders of the countries in the Eurozone. Oblivious to the global dimensions of the financial crisis, they took the view that if there was fallout for Europe, America would be to blame, so it would be for America to fix. I couldn't convince them that half the bundled subprime mortgage securities that were about to blow up and land in Europe, the Euro-era banks were in fact more highly leveraged than America's. Now, you know, he's saying that he's somebody who's really telling the general public what it was like talking to the bankers about fixing the crash back in 2008. And he's now saying that they're still not listening.
No, and of course, at the time, neither was he. I mean, the week before the crash, he was in the City of London at the Lord Mayor's banquet saying what a marvellous job the City of London was doing and how great they were for Britain. But he's sadder and wiser now. I think this intervention is quite interesting because he's had time to think about it. He's obviously put a lot of thought into this particular article. He's timed it in such a way.
He's put it in the New York Times, though. Why not the Guardian?
He's put it in the New York Times because he's speaking to an international audience, as I stressed earlier. It's not just about Bristol. It's not just about London. It's about the world. There is a financial crisis which is going to come. It doesn't matter where it starts. It could start in Greece. It could start in Detroit, it could start in Japan, it could start in China, and at some point there's going to be a crash because nothing has been done to change the fundamentals of how the financial system works. And what we've been doing is bailing out the financial system. The state all over the world, the US, Britain, the Eurozone, everywhere, have been bailing out the financial markets, and those who participate in those markets have been doing very, very well out of this intervention. So there's been massive intervention to keep those people happy, and in fact their asset values have gone up enormously. So the stock market is going up and everybody's making money who invest in the stock market. Meanwhile, the real economy is withering on the vine.
Well,
and at some point that cannot continue.
I think you're absolutely right to point this article out. It's absolutely fascinating. It had virtually no coverage here in Britain.
No.
For a former Prime Minister to say something so interesting. Just at the end of the article, he says, nearly 5 years on, the chairman of the Bank of England, Governor Mark Carney, speaks of uneven progress in recapitalising banks, making them disclose their risks. A very important phrase, making them disclose their risks, still not disclosing. The G20 plan for oversight of the shadow banking is as yet only a plan. Yes, well, nothing's actually happened with this.
No.
While the world's $600 trillion derivatives market is being regulated with new minimum capital and reporting requirements, global financial regulators must find a way to collaborate across borders, says Mr. Carney. In short, precisely what world leaders sought to avoid, a global financial free-for-all enabled by ad hoc unilateral actions, is what has happened. Political expediency, a failure to think and act globally, and a lack of courage to take on vested interests are pushing us inexorably towards the next crash. And Gordon Brown surely is someone who also failed to take on those vested interests.
He did, and you could say that in many ways it's all very well for him to say this now because he didn't do anything at the time. But the fact is that he's a senior person, and when he says there's going to be a crash, he's got plenty of people who he talks to who are on the inside and know what's going on. It's quite likely that that's what's going to happen. But of course, that's not the message that the present government, the coalition government in Britain, wants people to hear. What they should have been doing since they came to power several years ago is getting to grips with the financial system and reforming it. They haven't been doing that. They've been too busy kicking the poor with bedroom tax and all the rest of it.
Look,
totally irrelevant to the real circumstances we're in.
You mentioned earlier money. This does rather remind us that the whole we like to think of money as a kind of finite resource, maybe a certain amount of gold somewhere, that when we've got something in our bank account, we've got a little bit of that. But actually, it's not like that at all, is it? So let's go back now. And I came across a fascinating video online over Christmas, which was put up online, I think, in November last year, by a chap called Mike Maloney. It's called The Hidden Secrets of Money. So let's go back now to 650 BC, when the first thing that we could probably call modern money emerged. That's quite a lot of years, isn't it? 2,500 years plus another 100 or so. So, Mike Maloney now.
Now we come to the emergence of real money. Here we have little pieces of metal, just little pieces that have been broken off of bars or something that was cast, other little blobs of metal. that were traded as a currency. You know, they had purchasing power, they had an intrinsic value, but they still weren't fungible, which means interchangeable. Every one of them had a different value. You can see that some of them have a higher silver content, some of them have a higher gold content. These are called electrum. It's a mixture of gold and silver, naturally occurring. What you notice is that this is from the 7th century B.C., and then between the 7th and the 6th century, we're talking about somewhere between 680 and 630 B.C., the emergence of true money. Here we've got four coins. The large one is a one-third stater coin, and the other three are one-sixth stater coins. You can take so many of these in trade for so many of loaves of bread, and you don't have to break out your little scale and weigh them any longer. With the little chunks of metal, you had to weigh every transaction that was going on. You had to weigh whatever your payment was and then take a guess as to what the purity was. Here you have some standards that were set by mints and guaranteed by those mints. And they're a store of value over long periods of time. These still have purchasing power today, 2,600 years after they were made.
That's Mike Maloney there from his documentary, The Hidden Secrets of Money. Martin, we've come a long, long way since there. He mentions gold and silver. Some of this stuff, you know, actually you could trade it today. It's still worth something. But I'm afraid pound notes and pound coins, they say I promise to pay the bearer. But actually, when you go to the Bank of England and you ask for your little bit of gold or silver or whatever it is, they'll say, I'm sorry, you can't have any. Now, I believe we came off the gold standard of money back in the First World War, and we went back onto it, and then we came off again. What is the relationship between the modern money that we're printing like crazy now and money which has got some kind of redeemability? In other words, you can go and say, well, this is equivalent to a specific bit of gold in a bank somewhere.
Okay, well, the debate about the gold standard in the 30s was that there's only a finite amount of gold. And of course you dig more out of the ground and so on. It fluctuates slightly in price as a result of supply and demand conditions. But ultimately you might need more money in your economy than gold will provide.
So the if the demand is going up for money, then surely the value goes up of gold.
But that then chokes. It's difficult for entrepreneurs, for example, to borrow money.
Okay, so you're getting kind of,
so they've got a new idea, they've got a new widget they want to build.
What you're saying,
but they can't borrow the money to get started.
You start getting hoarding of the gold.
Yes, effectively, yes. So there was a debate about being. I mean, the advantage of being on a gold standard is that everybody knows what the score is, and it allows things to be predictable and so on. But the gold standard before the First World War was basically backed up by the Royal Navy. You know, it's basically ultimately these things are not really about money.
How do you
money.
Mean backed up by the Navy?
In the sense that the British system of the gold standard worked through London, but it worked because Britain was politically dominant and was able to enforce the gold standard and make other people adhere to it, whether they wanted to or not. And it fitted in with the ideology of the free market and all the rest of it. There was going to be and that this was the system which everybody operated. But the problem with it is that it's just too restrictive. And when you've got problems in the economy, and the economy's spluttering, for example, you need more money to be injected into the economy so that things can proceed. But the gold standard becomes a bit of a fetter. Anyway, at the end of the Second World War, the Bretton Woods system was set up, which was a modified gold standard. It was put together by negotiations mainly between the British and the Americans. And
John Maynard Keynes was
the British negotiator. What Keynes wanted, which was a bit idealistic, was a universal currency called Bancor, which would be backed by gold, ultimately, but would also be flexible. So, in other words, there were fixed but flexible exchange rates. So the value of the pound versus other currencies was allowed to fluctuate, but not by much, and all of them were ultimately related to the dollar, not to Bancor, to the dollar, because that's what the Americans insisted on. No, the dollar is going to be the one. But the dollar was supposedly backed by gold. But, of course, what happened in the 1970s was that the Americans were losing the Vietnam War, and at that point Nixon cynically said, we're all Keynesians now, and he took the dollar off gold, which allowed the US basically to print money, and it's been doing that ever since. Now, if anybody else tried to do that, if Britain tried to do that, it would cause catastrophe in the economy. But the US is able to do it because the dollar is the world's reserve currency, because it's backed by oil, not by gold. So the Saudis agreed to sell oil in dollars, and they're the swing producers in OPEC. And ultimately, everybody all over the world who wants to buy oil, and basically you need oil. What use is gold? You can't eat it. You can't do anything with it. Oil makes everything run. This studio is running on oil as we speak, one way or another. Oil is important. So the dollar is backed by oil, and people have got to buy oil in dollars. But of course, a lot of the wars we've been fighting is to ensure that people still have to use dollars to buy oil. So you could argue that, this is the reason why the invasion of Iraq took place, because Saddam Hussein wanted to start trading oil in euros, and the Libyans wanted to start trading oil in Libyan gold dinars.
Well, they were talking about actually starting an African dinar, weren't they?
Yes. All of which would completely undermine the US's dominant position in the international system. So when they took over the dominant position that Britain had before 1914.
So what you're saying is, as soon as the oil is not being traded in dollars, the dollar actually could collapse.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because it isn't actually backed by anything anymore. And also, the entire financial system over there is extremely shaky. We keep hearing about possible complete shutdowns of the government. In fact, the government has been shut down several times.
Yeah, but that's a bit of a diversion. The real problem is the collapse of the banks. The government will, you know, the government is, people are talking about as a government, the government has got a problem because it bailed the banks out. The Austrian school economists and the right-wing economists, the serious right-wing economists in the US, didn't believe in bailing the banks out. And I can see the argument. But, of course, if you don't bail the banks out, you're then going to have a mega crash. Now, they say, well, let's have a mega crash and then capitalism will just reboot. I would suggest that society can't take the strain of these crashes. But nevertheless, we're going to have one. They've been putting it off by printing money. But it doesn't actually solve the problem unless you reform the banking system, which they haven't been prepared to do. The bankers have far too much political power. They got bailed out and they just went back to the casino and carried on with their same old behaviours. And of course, that is actually disastrous.
Well, let's go back now to Mike Maloney's Hidden Secrets of Money documentary, because he has quite an interesting section on what part economics played in the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany and Adolf Hitler.
A few years ago, I was interviewing Congressman Ron Paul, and he said, I think that there's going to be a financial collapse before they come around to thinking seriously about monetary policy. But the real thing we have to worry about is not the loss of our wealth. It's the rise of a dictator. It's the loss of our freedom. And what's interesting is the rise of Hitler. There were two times where he played on the public sphere. He could never have come to power had there not been a hyperinflation back in 1923. Just 1 week before the end of that hyperinflation, that's when Hitler made his first big public appearance. Playing to the public fear, Hitler and his stormtroopers took over a beer hall called the Bürgerbrau Keller that seats around 3,000 people. And he took the stage by gunpoint, and to this literally captive audience, he gave the speech that would change the world. Because of the hyperinflation, the audience had been recently impoverished. Their wealth had been stolen by the government running the printing presses. And so they're all scared. He offers them a scapegoat and tells them he's got the way out. He became very popular after that, and the very next day, the people that were listening to him followed him in an attempt to overthrow the government. He was arrested, tried, and convicted of high treason and served time. While he was in jail, he was provided with a private secretary, Rudolf Hess, and he actually wrote about half of Mein Kampf while he was serving time. But once the economy started to recover, Hitler lost that leverage, that power. He could no longer play on the fear of the public once the economic situation had changed. By the middle of the Roaring Twenties, he had become a joke. The Nazi Party had gone to less than 2% of the vote. Then along came the Great Depression, and Hitler seized this opportunity again. He was the first politician to actually campaign by aircraft, hitting multiple cities in a single day. And the Nazi Party went from 2% of the vote to the second largest party in Germany. So playing on the public sphere, Hitler was able to take away the rights of Germans. He was able to, all these guaranteed rights in the Weimar Constitution, private property rights, the right to assemble, public assembly, the right to privacy in the mail, the telephone system. He just took away all of their rights and seized power. So these are some of the things that we have to be concerned about and be very mindful of. Economic crisis very often leads to the rise of a dictator.
Mike Maloney there from his documentary, The Hidden Secrets of Money. Martin, one of the most interesting points he's making there is this connection with the lack of privacy. Of course, we've seen that over this last probably 20 years or so, slow erosion of privacy. But what with Edward Snowden's revelations over the last 6 months or so, we're getting a very, very clear picture that very much of what we do is being actually tracked, watched, our passwords looked at, this kind of thing, and stored. What is effectively a massive database on every single one of us?
Indeed, and of course we've also got the economic problems in spades that they had in the 20s and the 30s.
Well, how would you compare the two, though? I mean, you think things are potentially worse here? One of the most fascinating things the former governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, said, I thought was brilliant, was fascinating, was that it was as if we'd been through a world war. But, I mean, we didn't feel a world war, but our economy has suffered in the same way.
Well, I think if you live in Iraq, you might disagree with that. I think the fact is that the war has been waged on humanity by this clique of bankers and militarists, and we are way down the slippery slope, in fact. People are still acting as if we lived in a relatively democratic society, and in a sense we do, and in a sense we don't. Real power has now moved to the financial markets, and to ultimately, of course, that means to military force, because that's ultimately how all these things are mediated. And what's been happening in the financial markets since 2008 is that we are being manipulated by the same forces that brought about the crisis in the first place, and a massive transfer of wealth is going on from ordinary people to these elites. Ron Paul, who was mentioned in the clip, and the libertarian right in the US.
He's a Republican, isn't he?
He's a Republican, yes. So this is quite interesting, and I think their analysis is in some respects quite enlightening. But at the same time, they miss the point that we could always have followed a free market policy in 2008 and allowed the banks to collapse. That would have been a free market policy. Now, you might have said the banks would have collapsed, there'd have been a bit of a shock, and then people would have adjusted, and then the system would have just come back. Now, in actual fact, I don't think the capitalist system is that robust. And once you have a crash on that scale, it doesn't come back. And you can see what happens. It's like what happened in Germany. You have a hyperinflation, followed by deflation, followed by what is essentially a planned economy run by the state, but a corporate state, so they keep private enterprise involved by giving them contracts and so on, unlike a Soviet-style solution. But these kind of solutions, I mean, there was a similar kind of thing going on in the US in the New Deal. It was more democratic. In Sweden, there was a democratic left-wing government that was trying to intervene in the market. Ultimately, capitalism is not a self-regulating system that can just be allowed to function and it'll all be all right as long as you don't meddle with it, which I'm afraid is Ron Paul's view. Ron Paul, for example, doesn't believe in things like national health services. He believes that everybody should provide for themselves by taking out insurance and so on. Now, frankly, that is just nuts. That's not the way to provide healthcare to ordinary people. And I think what's really interesting about the right wing in the US is that some of them are genuinely libertarian. They genuinely aren't happy with the banks being bailed out. They are in favour of civil liberties, so they've generally tended to support Edward Snowden, for example. And I think it's a matter of for example, over the Syria business that last year, it was the Ron Paul type Republicans who didn't want to fight in Syria, all of which I respect. But I don't necessarily agree with their economic analysis. I'm afraid capitalism cannot just be allowed to function. It is being manipulated by the financial wizards and by governments. But the alternative to that isn't free market capitalism with everybody looking after their own business and everything working out fine. The alternative to that is chaos and dictatorship. And I'm afraid chaos and dictatorship are definitely on the agenda as we go into 2014.
Martin, just finally, on the discussion there between looking at the hyperinflation in the 1920s, Wall Street crash in the early 1930s, would you draw some comparisons, as Mike Maloney does, between the situation there then and now?
Well, interestingly enough, I think I've shown you this, Tony. There is a graphic that shows the stock market in the US in the run-up to the 1929 crash and in recent months, and it's virtually identical. it's a much bigger, of course the stock market bubble is much bigger now, so we've got two different scales on the graph, one for the 1929 crash and one for the what may be the 2014 crash. Now of course the big difference between 1929 and 2014 is that money printing has become much more institutionalised, so it's quite possible that you could, through the money printing that's being done, have a much bigger bubble before the crash. But crash it will, I think. I don't think there's any doubt about that in my mind. You cannot run a capitalist system on money printing for years on end, as they are doing now, without having a crash. It will crash.
Okay, at some point maybe it will. If it does, what then?
Well, what then? People say, well, what should we do? Should we stock up on tinned food or whatever? I think what then, what should have been happening in the last 5 years, is that democratic politicians, backed up by democratic mass movements, should have been reading the Riot Act to the financial
elite. But haven't
elite.
Anyone that has been reading the Riot Act been actually moved sideways, sacked or whatever, gotten out of the way? That's because the financial elite want their people in the top of the civil
service, right.
Don't they?
Well, they want to control. I mean, isn't it astonishing that after the biggest crash in history, we spent 5 years arguing about whether people on benefits are scroungers or not? Meanwhile, the bankers are being bailed out to the tune of billions, and nobody asks a question about that because surely they know what they're doing. Can you see the cultural power that these people have? They've made a complete mess of everything. They've cost everybody a fortune, and yet they're lecturing us about what we've got to do to solve the crisis.
Talking about cultural power, we had Kevin Carhill on here the other day, the journalist, freelance journalist from London, author of Who Owns Britain, reminding us that all of the major newspaper empires in London have got much of their resources and money in tax havens. So they are a little bit nervous about making too much of a big fuss about corporate tax avoidance, because they are actually corporate tax avoiders themselves.
Well, yes, and most serious newspapers are run at a loss, as are simply as mouthpieces for people like Rupert Murdoch. And, the non-serious newspapers are not talking seriously about anything much, and are used as a propaganda organs to demonise the people that they want to be demonised. Ultimately, I'm afraid capitalism is a very, very robust system in terms of the ideology of it. We're all brought up with this, you can't spend what you haven't got and all this sort of stuff, and there's no free lunch. We all know the little cliches that go with it. And we are so, I mean, and also, of course, people can't imagine a life without capitalism. So therefore, by default, we end up trying to make it work, even though it's becoming more and more distorted and more dysfunctional. But at some point, it won't work. And then other things will have to be tried.
We've got local elections this year. We've got European elections, haven't we? What are your thoughts about how that's all going to go? Because certainly with the European elections, all the focus is going to be on UKIP. They're likely to steal quite a lot of the vote this time.
Well, I mean, what I'm pointing out, in the local elections, the turnout will be something like 30-odd%. If it's is the Euro election at the same time as the local election?
So,
probably,
yeah.
Is. Well, that means that the turnout for the Euro election will be perhaps 30-odd%. Now, that means that 70% of the population won't participate in either of those elections. So whatever UKIP may or may not win in those elections, it's hardly a mandate to do anything much. And if people want to vote for UKIP, they will. These political forces are entitled to exist, but what I would say to UKIP and anybody else who's listening, the banks are about to collapse and there's quite possibly going to be a world war. Now, what's your policy on that? Never mind you don't like gypsies, because we've heard that before and it's not really relevant to the circumstances we're in.
But the UK Independence Party, for example, have said they actually think it's a good idea for Syrian refugees to come to Britain because they're genuine asylum seekers, economic migrants.
Well, what happened was Nigel Farage said that he thought it might be a nice idea for Syrian refugees to come to Britain, and then a lot of his supporters said no, what are you talking about? And then he said well, Christian Syrian refugees could come to Britain. Now this is typical of the lack of seriousness about the whole issues that we're facing. The Syrian crisis is probably one of the biggest that we've faced in decades. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people on the move, and of course if you live in the countries right next to Syria, in Lebanon, in Turkey, in Iraq, this is a real disaster. And meanwhile we're arguing about we don't want those horrid Romanians coming here. Meanwhile, the banking system is tottering away in the background, as Gordon Brown pointed out. I want to hear from all serious politicians, including Nigel Farage, whose name implies that he must have been a French origin originally, a Huguenot, I suppose. I want to hear from all of these people, what are you going to do about the fact that the banking system is run by criminals and it's about to collapse? Never mind arguing about whether you like people coming here on benefits or not. That's an issue. I'm not saying it isn't. But get focused. because we nearly went to war with Russia over Syria, and the banking system is on the ropes. That's what I went to hear all serious politicians addressing. That's what people, they need to be told the truth, and we need to talk about it in a serious tone of voice.
Now, you say that we nearly went to war with Russia. There were certainly some missiles were fired.
By the Israelis.
And also, well, we're not sure who fired those missiles. And then also, this was all in the aftermath of a chemical weapons attack. Now, what are your thoughts about that, having had 6 months or so to digest it, to pull various threads together about what happened there? Just give us your analysis of that,
okay,
because it was probably one of the biggest events of last year, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's an awful lot to say about this, but I'll try and keep it brief and focused. Seymour Hersh is a very, very well-respected journalist in the US. Very well-respected. He's been around for many, many years. He exposed the My Lai massacre, if people remember that, in the 1970s. And he's never been proved wrong about anything. Now, he said two interesting things last year. He wrote a book in which he said that the so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden is a pack of lies from start to finish. And the reason, how does he know that? Because he's got lots and lots of informants on the inside of the US security forces. And the other thing he said, and he wrote this in the London Review of Books, is that there was no real evidence that the Assad regime had carried out this chemical weapons attack near Damascus. And in fact, there's quite a lot of evidence that Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia had supplied chemical weapons.
Not him again.
Well, this is what we're talking about, isn't it? And don't forget, Tony, let's remind ourselves that what supposedly happened on 9/11 was that 19 hijackers from Saudi Arabia crashed planes into buildings, although there is doubt about that in actual fact. But why is it having the Saudis are the fount of international jihadi terrorism? But they work very closely with our own security forces, don't they? I'm sure the British pop over there all the time to chat to them, and they chat to us because we're all on the same side. Yes, just like we were on the same side in the 1980s when we were trying to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. The Saudi security forces, the British security forces, trained a lot of jihadi terrorists to go in there and blow things up and kill people. No, they weren't terrorists, they were freedom fighters. That's right, freedom fighters. Margaret Thatcher died this year. She was responsible for that. Operation Cyclone, the jihadi terrorists running amok around the planet.
But can we get back to Ghouta, the sarin gas attack? That was pretty shocking. What we learnt since the initial...
Well, what's happened politically is that the Russians outplayed the West over this. They said, you've not got real evidence that Assad did it. And in actual fact, we've got evidence that it was your people. Don't forget that the French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, a few months ago, said that he was approached by the British, not the Americans, the British, before the Arab Spring, saying, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Now, it may well be that MI6 are behind the armed uprising in Syria. If they are, then Britain is responsible for all of these deaths. I'm not saying that Britain's solely responsible, but certainly bears some responsibility. And after all the huffing and puffing about this chemical weapons attack, if it turns out it was the Saudis behind the chemical weapons attack, when do we start bombing Riyadh? Or perhaps we're not going to bomb Riyadh. Of course we're not, because we're working with Riyadh. So it may not just be the Saudis who are behind the attack. The British and the Americans may have been involved as well. Now, ultimately, this shouldn't surprise anybody, because NATO intelligence services, just like the FSB, just like Mossad, they are terrorists. Ultimately, they're going to have to go to prison. But how are we going to do that? Well, first of all, we've got to call a spade a spade, and then we've got to get some serious police officers to do a serious job. And that's what's got to be done with the banks as well. And it's not just about winning elections.
Now, back to Syria, because we had the recall of Parliament, we had a vote, they decided not to back an attack on Syria. There was a lot of rolling back of thoughts and ideas, and this sent a message out around the world, really, saying, no, this isn't going to happen. That was certainly largely... played by Ed Miliband. He seemed to be one of the people kind of leading the opposition, the vote against Cameron. That week there was this weird attack, wasn't there, with two missiles suddenly appeared, and then we were told those missiles went into the sea. They were probably cruise missiles. I'm not sure who they were fired by, but they were certainly heading for Syria, weren't they?
Well, the official story is that the Israelis were carrying out a test of missiles in the eastern Mediterranean, and that's what was happened there. Others have suggested that they were either Israeli or US missiles that had been shot down by the Russians or whatever. The fact is that when it came to the crunch, the West backed down because the Russians have got things like the Iskander missile, the Iranians have got stuff like the Silkworm missile from the Chinese, and it's not even clear that you would win if you attack Syria. For example, the British base in Cyprus at Akrotiri, the Cypriot government said you are not to use that base to attack Syria, we forbid it, and the Syrians are saying, if you attack us, we are going to attack Akrotiri. Now that means that people in Britain better get ready for the idea that if you want to go to war with the Syrian Arab army, they will fight hard, and they've been fighting hard for 4 or 5 years. And that means that your young men will be in the firing line. And that is the problem that people in Britain have got, is they want to get involved in all of these things, and then they don't want to think through the consequences. How many people do you think died in Iraq this year? Just this year, 2013. Well, last year, 2013. A lot. A great deal. And everybody wants to go home and have a nice cup of tea.
I think it's something like 7,000, certainly the highest death toll so far, maybe 3,000 dead and 7,000 seriously injured in Iraq.
Yes, and a lot of those people in Iraq will have been killed by Sunni jihadi terrorists who we are supporting to overthrow the government of Assad in Syria. But of course, Assad's government is supported by the Democratic Government of Iraq and the Democratic Government of Lebanon. How democratic those governments are, I wouldn't like to say, but they're as democratic as anyone we've got.
The trouble is, when you arm people and help people with intelligence to do targeting, they don't always necessarily attack the people you want them to attack.
Well, also, of course, there's all sorts of things that can go wrong when you start blowing things up, let's face it. But the fact is that all of the Western intelligence services, the Russian intelligence services, the Israeli intelligence services, they are all involved in fomenting terrorism. Frankly, that what went on in Afghanistan in the 80s, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan boasted about it. They said, what a great thing we've done here. We set up all these Islamists, we gave them guns, we gave them bombs, and they defeated the Red Army. Aren't we good? That's what they said. And then afterwards said, oh, it's nothing to do with us, these Islamic terrorists. Where did they come from? I'll say where they came from is, as Robin Cook pointed out when he was Foreign Secretary, Al-Qaeda simply means the base. And the base was a database held in Jordan of all of the Islamic terrorists from places like Libya that had been trained by Western special forces and infiltrated into Afghanistan. That's where Al-Qaeda came from. Now, at what point did the Al-Qaeda set up by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher morph into the Al-Qaeda we're fighting now, supposedly? Because in actual fact, I would say they're the same organisation and the strings are pulled by the intelligence service.
Okay, well, another fascinating story this week, hardly covered at all, but really interesting, this one. It reminded me of Guantanamo Bay. It was like torture inside America's deadliest fraternity. This is a Bloomberg story in The Independent on Wednesday this week. The brutality of initiation ceremonies into Greek frat houses has come to light after some of the abused students broke their silence. John Hechinger and David Glovin report on behaviour likened to torture in Guantanamo Bay. It wasn't easy to get the words out. Stuart was naked apart from his underwear and standing in a trash can filled waist-deep with ice. Fraternity members sprayed him with a hose and poured buckets of water over his head, convinced that Sigma Alpha Epsilon would bring him social success in college and a Wall Street job. The lanky recruit from a suburban Maryland endured the abuse. During an 8-week initiation in 2012, Sigma Alpha Epsilon Brothers at Salisbury University in Maryland beat Stuart with a paddle, forced pledges to drink until they almost passed out, and dressed them in women's clothing and nappies. Stuart said fraternity members confined recruits for as long as 9 hours in dark basements with no food or water or in the bathroom while blasting the same German rock song at ear-splitting volumes. According to Stuart, testimony of another former pledge and the findings of the university's disciplinary board. It honestly reminded me of Guantanamo Bay, Stuart said. It was almost like torture. Yet when they started looking into this, Martin, they found that the authorities and the university didn't even seem to want to stop it. I mean, in another article in Rolling Stone magazine, which came out earlier in the year, we hear 60 students in the United States have died in these, what they call hazing, these initiation ceremonies into these fraternities. And these fraternities are backed by postgraduates who've made it in the financial world, and they give millions and millions to these specific clubs, basically, which can then help you go through university once you've been initiated, and as he says, get you a nice job in Wall Street.
Well, am I surprised? No, I'm not surprised.
Well, we don't hear very much about this.
No, we don't.
I mean, it certainly isn't a meritocracy if you basically say, well, I'm going to go through this torture and then I can get a nice job in Wall Street.
No, it's not a meritocracy when you crash the financial system and you get bailed out. that was the end of the free market ideology. But nobody seems to have accepted this, certainly not in this coalition government. Once you've bailed out, ultimately there is no free market. Ultimately, when you've bailed the system out, and these basically crony capitalist clubs end up getting all the money. But it's not based on... How many people in here have invented a better widget? Or invented a light bulb? Or a new way to, grow food? Nothing at all about that, is there? What you do, if you want to get rich, is you go and join one of these little clubs.
The interesting thing about
you make sure the government bails you out when you crash.
Is that these fraternities are all surrounded by this absolute brick wall of secrecy. The fact is that your livelihood in future years for your family, etc., totally depends on whether you're in or out of this fraternity. And it sounds like the Freemasons or something, you know, because the secrecy is absolute. And the reason I mention it is it's so rare that you get somebody who will actually talk about what really went on. And then expose the cover-up, the subsequent cover-up, when people... Mm. I mean, 60 deaths, for goodness sake, in the last 10 years or so.
Well, yes, and of course, ultimately, groups like this, like Propaganda Duo in Italy, which was the Freemasons' lodge at the heart of the state, it had all of the sort of top intelligence people, bankers, civil servants in it, they were behind the terrorism in Italy, according to Fernando Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who published a book in December 2012... about based upon police investigations into all of this, because he was an investigating magistrate in the Aldo Moro case and so on. There is no doubt about it, Western intelligence services using these networks are involved in terrorism. They have been for decades.
Okay, another story. Resurgent Cameron, this is a bit of a bad one for you, Martin, as a member of the Labour Party. Resurgent Cameron cuts into Miliband's lead in the polls. The Conservatives have halved Labour's opinion poll lead over the last year, while support for UKIP has slowly ebbed away from a dramatic peak in the spring. The latest poll of polls discloses today. As the political parties enter 2014, findings will provide David Cameron with grounds for cautious optimism. The Tories can claw back the narrowing Labour advantage by the time of next year's general election. Doing very well, Martin.
Well, I think the fact is that the ideology production machine of the media, of people like Murdoch and so on, basically constantly misdirect people about what the issues are. And the Labour Party has always got to work uphill against that. I think the fact is that most people realise that they're not getting much out of this so-called recovery, whatever it is. But the real point, as Gordon Brown pointed out, is that there's every possibility that there's going to be a full-on crash. And I don't see anybody in the coalition government who's really taken on board.
Martin, we've been here before, haven't we? There's not going to be a full-on crash. All the time, the financial elite can continue milking the system as they are. They're actually acquiring massive amounts more assets all the time.
They are. And, of course, a crash is not necessarily a disaster for them. Because they see it as an opportunity to buy things for pennies on the pound. But the fact is that a crash, if it comes, will finally put the nail in the coffin of this super free market ideology which has dominated Western political discourse for the last 30 years. Absolutely silly. We knew from 1940s onwards not to manage things like this, and we've basically had a rake's progress of doing silly things. Started in the Margaret Thatcher era, and it's been going on ever since. But ultimately, as was pointed out earlier, you have a major economic crisis and then you have political dictatorship if you're not careful.
Well, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. After the news, we look ahead to 2014 again, and also Monday sees the first barrister's strike in Britain for 700 years. We're joined, we hope, by Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.